This is Radio EcoShock with Alex Smith.
Welcome to Radio EcoShock, 650 original programs since 2006, now broadcast by over 100 nonprofit radio stations in five countries. This program is also available free on the World Wide Web by podcast, SoundCloud, YouTube, and downloads. You're about to travel from the distant past to the deep future with well-known scientist David Archer from the University of Chicago. Then let's explore climate disinformation. Just as Russia has been outed pushing the anti-vaccine movement, Mother Jones reveals the American fossil fuel industry is literally gaslighting consumers, planting fake voices, pretending to be your neighbor. Among the list of countries suppressing or silencing climate science, we find Russia, Canada, Australia, the United States, and of course, every Middle East oil state. Even the big guys struggling to go green like Microsoft's Bill Gates still donate to elect climate-denying politicians. It's a mess. But we begin with real science. Burning fossil fuels almost ended all life on Earth. Science journalist Peter Brannon took Atlantic magazine readers there when he wrote about the planet's worst mass extinction. Professor David Archer has used Brennan's work teaching a paleoclimate class at the University of Chicago. That is just one of several specialties where Archer excels. A lot of his work centers around world oceans and climate change. David is the author of five books, including The Long Thaw, How Humans Are Changing the Next 100,000 Years of Earth's Climate. From Chicago, David Archer, welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
Hi, Alex. Great to talk to you.
It's pretty crispy in the Windy City right now. The UK is shivering too. Can we blame excursions of extreme cold on global warming?
I think you're on thin ice if you do that. There is talk about the waviness of the jet stream getting more extreme as you decrease the temperature difference between the equator and the pole. So more, you know, excursions of polar air and whatnot. But that's still a topic in discussion. It's not a slam dunk by any means yet.
Let's get to your work. In a paper published in July 2020, you examine the ultimate cost of carbon. It's really hard to imagine how humans might live hundreds of years from now, but what did you find out about the real cost of free dumping greenhouse gases into the atmosphere?
Hundreds of thousands of years, Alex. Not just hundreds of years. That's how long the CO2 that we release today will impact the climate in the future. And that was what I was at between those sort of geologic timescales in the future and the kind of human timescales that, economic analysis kind of encompasses.
Well, there is a dark assumption in the paper about the deep future, and I'd just like to quote this slightly complicated sentence. You say that you estimate climate impacts as fractional decreases in economic activity, potentially amplified by a human population response to a diminished human carrying capacity. Should we assume there will be a diminished human carrying capacity for people on this planet?
Well, it's pretty much impossible to forecast the deep future with any reliability. You know, you read what people predicted 100 years ago for now, and where are the flying cars? So I didn't really want to go there. So we treated humanity the way you would some other biological system, you know, without the possibility of technological advancement, just because that's what we are able to do. We had to sort of isolate the climate change impact as it would affect agriculture and human habitability kind of as it has been. But, you know, what the future holds is totally beyond the scope of anything I could think about or get anybody else to help me think about. So we kind of, you know, pencil humanity as a technological society out of the equation, and we're just talking about people as if we were a simple biological system. You know, if you have more room for a certain type of organism, you'll have more of that organism, you know, more mosquitoes in a warmer world, for example. That's kind of how we had to approach it.
But why try to calculate what it will cost people long into the future?
It's hard to think about deep time for people who aren't trained geologists who have acclimated to thinking about it, especially to think about it in the future. so the paper was sort of an attempt to change the units. So the global warming timescale is to the economic timescale as the ultimate cost of carbon of hundreds of thousands of dollars per ton is to the immediate cost of carbon to us of, like, what, $50 a ton or something like that they come up with. So it's just kind of a trying to change the units into something that people can get their heads around more easily. It's just making a point.
Well, I guess if there's going to be increased storms, droughts, heat, and all that, it's going to keep costing people, as long as there are people, for a very, very long time. And that seems to be one of the major points of your exercise there in the paper.
Well, one thing that isn't obvious from the public discussion of climate change is that sea level rise doesn't stop in the year 2100, which is pretty much when most of our, you know, projections kind of stop. Ultimately, the ice sheets take thousands of years to respond, hopefully not less than that. And at that time, the sea level rise that we provoke now could be, you know, 50 meters or something like that. And a lot of our agricultural land is low-lying land in river deltas that are very fertile. So, yeah, it's a significant downgrade, potentially.
And some of your other work reminds me of Alan Weisman and his book, The World Without Us. Weisman found the secret behind all our structures is maintenance. And if maintenance stops, skyscrapers fall, bridges go down, many signs of humans' existence disappear within a few hundred years. But you scanned the deep future landscape and you found mercury. Tell us about that.
Oh, this is another thing that I was working on, was a model of how mercury cycles in the ocean. It wasn't my discovery in that paper. It was a researcher named Helen Amos, whom I've never met, but she's written these fantastic papers about the mercury cycle on Earth, which it gets released to the atmosphere from coal combustion and small-scale gold mining and things like that. It actually exists as a gas in the atmosphere for something like a year, which means that it can travel all around the world before it deposits. So it's a global issue, which makes it much harder to solve politically than when things are more local. But then after it deposits, after it comes back down to the ground, to the land surface or the ocean, it tends to recycle again back to the atmosphere. So the whole biosphere, including the organic carbon pools on land and the deep ocean, is like a giant mercury flywheel that we're charging up with mercury, and it will continue to poison the seafood and, you know, affect ecosystems and people for something like 8,000 years is what the estimate is, which is astonishing to me that we could cause a degradation to the planet that can't even in theory be fixed. We could in theory clean up the CO2 in the atmosphere, because half of the CO2 we ever emitted is still in the air. So if we could filter some fraction of the air, we could, you know, clean it up. But only a tiny fraction of the mercury that we have released is in the atmosphere, a few percent maybe. And a lot of the mercury that's raining down on us now is what's called legacy anthropogenic. It's stuff that was released back in the gold rush and times like that, which, you know, has gone to ground and recycled again. So it's just this immense mercury flywheel that we're getting going.
Well, when I was studying pulp mill damages, there was a pulp mill in Minamata, Japan, which was using mercury as a slimicide on its logs, and that got out into the bay and into the seafood of the people there, and they had all sorts of birth defects, and this can pass on through a couple of generations. It's terribly toxic stuff we're talking about.
Yeah, it's just like kryptonite for us. It just unhinges us in lots of different ways.
So is there a technical fix where we can just clean the mercury back out and go back to previous life?
Not even optimistically, no. No, it's out there. It's just going. You can't, you know, dig up all the organic carbon in the soils and treat it. It's gone to ground. And the deep ocean, you know, can't clean that.
Well, speaking of technical fixes, I was a bit alarmed when you recommended two books, both of them about geoengineering our way out of the climate crisis. We have Elizabeth Colbert's new book, How to Cool the Planet, Geoengineering and the Audacious Quest to Fix Earth's Climate, and then Oliver Morton with The Planet Remade. My first reaction is, are we already at that last resort point? Are we that desperate now?
Well, it's not a way out of the climate problem. If anything, it's sort of a temporary Band-Aid. And we don't want to leave the climate on life support for future generations so that if something broke down and they didn't keep putting sulfur in the stratosphere, suddenly they would get clobbered with all the climate change all at once. That's not, you know, a fix exactly for the climate change. But I thought the Oliver Morton book made a good case for how it could happen about, say, some country that got its carbon footprint act together. New Zealand came to mind when I was reading it. It logistically, it's not that hard for someone to shoot sulfur up into the stratosphere and engineer the climate. The only way we would know that some country was doing that was by tracking who was buying lots of sulfur that they don't need for anything else. You couldn't measure that this was happening really from a satellite, I don't think. So then this country might say, okay, announce that they're doing this and then allow any other country that also gets their carbon footprint together to help in making the decision about, you know, how much to dial the thermostat back, which is a very tricky question on a global planet with all different climates like ours. You know, he argues that we've already hacked the biosphere. The nitrogen cycle is totally whacked out by the Haber-Bosch process of making fertilizers. And, you know, there are other examples, I'm sure, of ways in which the world is totally not natural anymore. Remember Bill McKibben's book, The End of Nature? That was kind of heartbreaking.
It was, and it turned a lot of people towards, I think, thinking better about the environment. In other papers, you consider an alternative past. What would have happened if atmospheric carbon dioxide was lower when the coal revolution got rolling in the mid to late 1700s?
Well, this is interesting. I sort of draw the analogy to the first nuclear bomb test, where there was an outside possibility that the bomb could set the atmosphere on fire, basically, and end all life on Earth. And so they thought about it, and they came up with what the critical reaction cross-sections are or whatever the parameter, and they decided, oh, it's not going to happen, so let's just go ahead and do it. When we started burning coal, it was kind of like that, only the critical parameter for, you know, what was going to happen is the amount of CO2 that was in the air at that time, which is important because the change in the climate depends on the ratio, how much the CO2 changes, how many doublings of CO2 you exert. And so if you start from more CO2 in the natural atmosphere, the CO2 you add doesn't lead to as many doublings as if the amount that you had originally was lower. And the amount that was there in the natural world was set by this amazing CO2 thermostat mechanism that on long timescales, too long to help us out of our personal mess, unfortunately, but over geologic time, the CO2 finds the level where it balances the carbon cycle, CO2 coming out of the Earth in degassing volcanoes and hot springs and things, versus the weathering reactions that dissolve calcium and grab the CO2 and make it into calcium carbonate that goes to the seafloor, which is how the carbon goes back into the Earth. So if the settings of that thermostat had been much different, if the sun had been warmer, for example, or if the Earth had been just a few percent closer to the sun, or if intelligent life had happened a billion years later when the sun was naturally hotter or something, the CO2 could have been lower when we discovered coal, in which case what happens is the trajectory of the climate change just gets shifted earlier in time. So the fact that there was CO2 in the air when we discovered coal kind of masked the climate changes that resulted from that, you know, until this day. So if the CO2 had been like 10 times lower than it turned out to be, which it could easily have been, and nobody at that time knew what it was or the significance of that number, the climate changes that we're seeing now would have happened around, you know, 1900 or something like that, when Svante Arrhenius was kind of making an educated guess about how much CO2 might change the climate, but there was no way to know for sure, and the data was terrible, and, you know, we have much more options today to change our energy usages and things like that. So it really helped us out. It gave us a break that there was so much CO2 already in the air. It's like a long fuse. You light a long fuse, and it takes a while before the bomb goes off. So it was, you know, kind of one of the reviewers called it exo-sociology or something like that, which seemed to me I should get an institute about that. That's a kind of, I think that rear view is not being positive, but I kind of thought that was pretty funny.
Right. People say, well, we can't think about what's going to happen to humanity 2,000 years ago. But, you know, the Romans did. They built roads that are still in use in Europe today, 2,000 years later. What would have happened if the Romans had discovered coal and technology? And, well, where would we be now?
We'd be angry at the Romans, I believe.
Yes,
we would. You know, say if hurricanes didn't exist before they did that thing, and so every hurricane that hit, we could blame them. How would we feel about that? I wouldn't want to be a Roman in that case. I don't want to leave that legacy personally.
This is Radio EcoShock. Light up your iPod or computer with tons of free green audio from our website at www.ecoshock.org. That's ECO, shock like an electric shock, .org.
You are tuned to Radio EcoShock. We are talking with David Archer from the University of Chicago. David, do you still help moderate the Real Science blog, and how is that going?
Real Climate? No, Real Climate has kind of collapsed. Just speaking for myself, I don't know. I've lost a lot of my vim and vigor about, you know, public outreach. I honestly, the last 4 years have been kind of crushing, and I sort of felt like we as a society no longer have enough, you know, objective reality in common to even make it worth talking. I just, you know, I feel like I've said what there is to say, and yeah, no, I'm not out there fighting the great war anymore. I stopped flying for carbon footprint reasons maybe 5-6 years ago, and my wife keeps telling me if I'm going to do that and inconvenience everybody in my life, I should at least write some sort of manifesto explaining why I'm doing it, and I just don't even have the drive to do that.
It's so interesting you say this, because a number of climate communicators have stepped back from the public arena. Robert Scribler stopped his influential climate blog. Professor Peter Ward was advising TV documentaries, published 3 books. Now he's pretty quiet. Maybe the science is all in and there's not much left to say.
Well, it does seem like the only evolution in the science is that things seem to happen faster than we had expected them to, like ice streams and glaciers in the West Antarctic ice sheet and sea ice in the North Atlantic and things like that. You know, things are only sort of getting kind of worse, but they're not fundamentally changing. There's no, and it almost seems like there's less pushback on the other side too. The sort of, you don't correct me if you have seen differently, but it seems like there's less papers that are like deliberate attempts to deceive and say that climate doesn't change for whatever reason. It's like the whole debate has just gone into the background with more immediate concerns of not getting sick and whatnot, maybe.
I think there is less active climate denialism. Some of the big corporations that were funding it and doing it directly are a little more embarrassed. But I think the Russians are still at it, and there's still fossil fuel lobbyists doing what they do. Now, you know, it seems to me humans always want to know how our survival drama turns out. There's just like an almost cult-like yearning to get into this climate emergency right now, full bore, and get it over with. And, you know, maybe like the methane bomb crowd, they expect a final act. But really, from my reading of your work in climate change, it seems like we should more expect death by a thousand cuts.
Yeah, I don't know what to say. I guess, yeah. I sort of view it as a waste management problem. One way to frame it is that back in Victorian London, everybody used to just poop in chamber pots and throw it in the streets, I guess, and it just became unworkable. And so they built a river or something to carry the sewage so that it would at least go into the river downstream of the city, something like that, a rudimentary, you know, sewage processing thing. And it's probably controversial in its day because probably only the poor people got sick and so the rich people didn't want to pay for it. But looking back on it now, it was just not an option to keep pooping in the streets. And I think that's totally the way it is with putting our CO2 in the atmosphere. It's just not a workable thing. But, you know, we haven't come to grips with that yet.
A few years ago, I interviewed the Canadian climate scientist Andrew Weaver, and he removed himself from science for a while, and he successfully ran as a Green Party candidate for the legislature in my home province here in British Columbia. I wonder, is it time for more scientists to get political, to get the changes that we all know we need?
Maybe, but it's not going to come from me. I could never win. I'm not a leader of people. You know, I'm not very good at that. I think it takes a certain type to go, you know, inspire people to do things that they wouldn't have done. And maybe it's time for Greta Thunbergs of the world to do that. I mean, the science is in. You don't need old guys to tell you about the science. You need young people to say, this is my planet that you're trashing.
Well, putting our cards on the table, do you think that humans will react in time to save ourselves from a hard period of heat, drought, storms, and all that stuff?
I guess my best hope is that eventually we will start cleaning CO2 out of the atmosphere, because that's the only way to fix this. And one of the really startling things about that possibility is how incredibly expensive it would be, given the costs that you can read about from David Keith, for example, who's talking about direct air capture. You know, Bill McKibben sort of set up the goalposts that a safe level of CO2 is about 350. That's the level that would negate the energy imbalance at the top of the atmosphere. So it would mean that a planet wouldn't get any warmer than that. You know, just to get to that, just to get the CO2 back down to 350 would be a massive, massive task. But, you know, if we decided to do it, we could do it. I could imagine sort of big companies like analogous to defense contractors or something that, you know, once they get a gravy train, they get, you know, paid to scrub CO2 out of the atmosphere enough where they have their own lobbyists, then we're good. It's just getting to that point.
Do you think that this COVID-19 will or is skewing our relationship to the climate threat?
It'll be interesting to see. You know, one of the ways that we burn carbon is traveling around a lot, and I was sort of declining invitations to go speak at places and offering to do it by video, you know, long before COVID started, and rarely did anybody take me up on that. They always wanted a real physical body. And maybe we've gotten used to talking on, you know, remotely now, so, you know, that could be a thing. In terms of the CO2 in the atmosphere, I've read a couple papers about whether you can detect COVID in the trajectory of CO2 in the atmosphere, and really you basically can't, because a lot of the carbon emissions is still going on, and it's an accumulating pollutant. So, you know, it's like watching the odometer on a bicycle. If you stop pedaling or slow down a little bit pedaling for a little while, it doesn't really change the odometer reading all that much in a year or something like that, or you know, a short time.
But I do worry about science in the big picture, because like an Antarctic expedition was canceled, the COP meeting, the big climate meeting was canceled, and some science conferences aren't happening, so scientists aren't getting those times over a beer to talk about these things. And also we have a public who apparently is more willing to believe anything rather than the facts. We've got all this conspiracy theory things going. So I worry about the position of science in society now.
Yeah, well, we're still sort of, I was going to say a science-based society, but it's not even really necessarily, I worry too. If we don't have, you know, objective reality in common that we all acknowledge, then what do we have?
Well, I hope you won't be insulted when I say this, but I still picture you as the kind of kid who would find something interesting and dig and scurry right after it until you find it. And you've done that several times in your career. Where are you going now? What are you working on these days?
I'm working on trying to do a model of the chemistry of the Earth, you know, kind of like the burner model that predicted the silicate thermostat that, you know, changes through time. But that model didn't have maps in it. It was just the only dimension in it was time. So you had some parameter that you would turn when mountains come up that you say, in fact, the weathering or something like that. But my goal is to sort of expand that into a framework that includes the plates moving around and deposition of sediments that happens when you have uplift over here, and then the stuff gets transported over there and sort of deposits. And so it seems like, you know, there are detailed models of the atmosphere, you know, that show individual storms and oceans that show the geography of where the basins are and things like that. But in terms of this large-scale geochemical carbon cycle, there are no models that incorporate maps. And if you want to compare the results of such a model with, you know, real geological data, a lot of that data is sort of the thickness of these sedimentary layers and their chemistry and whatnot. So it's trying to investigate phenomenon like the uplift of the Himalayas responsible maybe for the fact that we're in an ice age today and other sorts of things like that in the deep past.
I just read a paper about that, which put forward the idea that we had about a billion years of very quiet activity, no mountain building on Earth, and during that time there was very little evolution either, so it seems like you need mountains in order to have evolutionary changes.
Could be. I'm going to get together with some colleagues and discuss a recent review paper about the snowball Earths, which also seem to be implicated somehow in, first off, not quite extinguishing the eukaryotic life that, you know, turned into multicellular animals and whatnot, but also the multicellular stuff kind of popped into being right after the snowballs ended and oxygen went up. And so it definitely seems like some kind of a birth trauma of the biosphere.
It's kind of ironic that we're recovering the memory of what Earth has been just at the very time when we seem likely to destroy a lot of the things that generate that knowledge if we're not very, very careful. I don't know where you fit on the optimism-pessimism scale. Where do you?
It varies wildly from, you know, day to day. You know, if you're factoring into optimism-pessimism, what I think humanity will do. But I agree that the paleoclimate reconstructions are a really powerful motivation for concern about the future. The Holocene has been something like 10,000 years of extremely stable, flat climate. And before that was the deglaciation and all these abrupt climate changes where, you know, the climate in the North Atlantic and around the world would change just in a few years because of flip-flops of ocean circulation and sea ice and things like that. You know, the whole climate change discussion seems like it would be sort of sterile without the perspective of the past. You know, 5 years ago, I sort of had the feeling that bringing up the end Permian extinction and other disasters like that was a bit over the top in terms of, you know, climate change. But reading Brannon's book about the extinctions or the papers that are behind it, a lot of them had to do with CO2 from volcanoes, you know, big, large igneous provinces, huge amounts of CO2 coming out, causing changes in biology. So there's a lot of parallels, which makes it really sobering.
We have just spent time with Professor David Archer, author and American scientist at the University of Chicago. Find links to David and the science we talked about in my weekly show blog at ecoshock.org. Thank you, David. It's always stimulating talking with you.
It certainly is, Alex. Thank you so much.
I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock.
You're listening to EcoShock Radio for the world.
I'm Alex Smith. Get it all at our website, ecoshock.org.
This is Radio EcoShock with your host, Alex Smith.
On Radio EcoShock, you hear scientists discuss the big risk of methane in several of my recent programs. They're available free, as always, at ecoshock.org. But why methane? Also known as natural gas, methane creates about 28% of the greenhouse effect that is warming this planet in many dangerous ways. We can reduce human methane leaks relatively inexpensively, but to really stop the run of this gas, we need to cure our addiction to fossil fuels. On the dark side, we have the methane fear. Last week with guest Sarah Saidi, and the week before with Andrew McDougall, We've covered concern about large amounts of methane escaping from the permafrost under the Siberian side of the Arctic Ocean. Plant life long dead, decayed, and now frozen in shallow seas is thawing under warmer seas. The Russians, often funded and aided by Swedish institutions and scientists, have sent over a dozen expeditions to measure methane in those Arctic waters. That is necessary science, and it should continue. We've got to keep monitoring it. But I think that information is also being used as disinformation and a kind of sly climate cover-up, and I'm going to go into that now. For those just tuning in, here is a fast rehash of the plot. In 2008, a Russian scientist, then assigned to the University of Alaska Fairbanks, wrote this in a 2008 paper. We consider release of up to 50 gigatons of predicted amount of hydrate storage as highly possible for abrupt release at any time, end quote. By hydrate storage, she means methane long buried, frozen under the sea. In a 2010 paper, Natalia Shakova and her partner, Igor Samilyatov, modified this a bit, talking about, quote, a total emission of 50 gigatons of methane over 50 years, end quote. There were many joint Swedish-Russian expeditions to study methane in the Arctic Sea from 1999 to 2009. From time to time, other nations joined in, providing some funds and scientists. Remember, there is very little subsea frozen carbon in Arctic seas bordering Canada and Alaska. The big problem, if that ever comes, would be in the shallow East Siberian Shelf. Given the tight control by Moscow of all science and institutions of higher learning, the routine for these expeditions was pretty well the same. The only way to enter tightly controlled Russian waters was by permission of the central government in Moscow. Requests for expeditions were all sent to Igor Samilyatov, and he had to be in control of the ship and the data gathering. I spoke confidentially with a Swedish scientist who complained that while they had paid the costs of the expedition, the raw data collected on methane coming up from the sea was kept by Samilyatov and never released to them or to the international community. It is hard to verify that, but this is the pattern for over two decades. Scientists in other countries, the media, and environmental activists must depend on the summary of results by Natalia Shakova and Igor Samilyatov. Until recently, there's been no other direct data source. A satellite was launched in recent years to measure methane, but that data has not been made available to the general public nor to journalists as yet. After doing dozens of interviews on this topic with experts and countless hours of research, here's how I think this methane story developed. Natalia Shakova and Igor Samilyatov were among a number of Russian scientists who became concerned about a grave danger that could come from the Arctic Ocean as permafrost in shallow seas warmed. They managed to mount expeditions to study this, even during the late 1900s, when post-Soviet scientists were not getting paid or they were going to work in other countries. A number of scientists in other countries saw this as a legitimate concern, and a big one, if it happened. The truth is, after more than a dozen expeditions and many millions of dollars in work hours spent, the duo failed to prove there are significant new amounts of methane rising up from the eastern Siberian sea shelf. There are stories, there are ominous warnings, there are news items about it, but there is no baseline to know how much methane has been bubbling up there for thousands of years anyway. How can we know if it's increasing? As experts have explained in at least a half dozen Radio EcoShock shows, the growing burden of methane, which is expanding in the atmosphere, but it's not coming from the Arctic, no matter how shrill a few voices are. At least, not yet. Let's take the yearly warning in the UK Guardian newspaper that came out in last year. The headline warns, Arctic methane deposits starting to release, scientists say. It continues, exclusive. Expedition says preliminary findings indicate that new source of greenhouse gas off East Siberian coast has been triggered, end quote. But look at how it all goes away with a whimper in this part of the story, quote, at this moment, there is unlikely to be any major impact on global warming. but the point is that this process has now been triggered. Well, yeah, that's just great. So the latest is this. The whole methane fear is unlikely to have any major impact on global warming. Other scientists would point out this release of methane from subsea deposits has not just been triggered. According to our expert assessment, gathered by Sarah Saidi, including from five Russian permafrost experts, frozen plant matter at the bottom of the East Siberian Shelf has been releasing its carbon load for maybe 42,000 years. From this tiny source of two scientists, and disputed loudly by hordes of scientists in the West, a whole branch of climate watchers became convinced we are doomed. It's all too late now, because, you know, the methane bomb. It's become like a kind of math that adds up instantly. Who gains if we believe the climate struggle is pointless now? Fossil fuel companies and fossil fuel states. Russia could benefit from this panic in several ways. First, it distracts people away from their own vast responsibility for climate wrecking through their natural gas industry, which along with oil, well, that has founded and it funds the modern Russian state, no doubt about it. That is where the money for the $500 million yachts Florida states purchased at twice the price that Trump paid for it, countless homes in the most expensive parts of the UK, especially London, that's where it all comes from, gas and oil. But people are encouraged to fear nature, a possible doom from a faraway place where humans are obviously not to blame. As we know, the scraps released by American intelligence agencies tell us the Russians are working to create any sort of fear and dissent in democratic countries that could threaten the Russian government or Russia itself. In a speech around 2005, Vladimir Putin made it clear Russia could never hope to keep up with American military spending. So his government invested in information warfare instead, and so far they are winning. If you think it is far-fetched that the Russian government has helped push the Arctic methane bomb narrative, consider how tightly Russian science is controlled. Almost all scientists there depend upon Russian government funding. Those who investigate unsavory things, like the emissions of natural gas industry, would either lose their funding or submit their reports for editing by the central government. And anyway, the state-controlled media would have to report on it, wouldn't they? Nonprofits, including Greenpeace, are kept on a tight leash when operating inside Russia. There's no way Shakova and Samilyatov produce their annual methane warning without direct funding by the Russian government, the same government who gives permits and sets all the rules for any other scientist wanting to investigate Russian waters. This Arctic methane story brings foreign funding into Russian science, helps pay for an Arctic research ship and crew, and does not draw attention to human-made Russian methane emissions. It unsettles some people in the West, but there could be another subplot. What if the world becomes completely convinced Arctic methane will ruin world agriculture and maybe civilization? Maybe the big corporations, the big money, and large governments could all mount a large effort to rush into the Arctic and capture the methane before it reaches the atmosphere. Somebody sends thousands of drilling rigs into the Arctic to drill into the seabed and capture that methane first. The gas is then given a priority as a source for whatever gas is still being burned in the world at that time. At least we get to use the methane, harness the energy, and reduce it to carbon dioxide before it kills us all, right? Is that too far out for you? Well, Malcolm Light said we should do it. Malcolm Light is the retired Texas oil geologist who helps run the Arctic News blogspot, and he's partnered with the English academic with the online name Sam Karana. Malcolm was also the founding member of the Arctic Methane Emergency Group, but he has since left them, I'm told. One of Light's core articles was posted on the Arctic Methane Emergency Group website, but has since been taken down. The title is Global Extinction Within One Human Lifetime, as a result of a spreading atmospheric methane heat wave and surface firestorm. Now that does sound possible and very scary. It looked like a scientific paper from Malcolm Light, but it was far from it. Guy McPherson has cited Malcolm Light's work as one reason why humans will go extinct before 2040, or is it 2030? And most recently, he said, by 2026. Malcolm Light pronounced our death sentence and day of execution with absolute certainty, putting it right around the year, well, 2031 in August, or in 2047 maybe for the Southern Hemisphere in June. His alleged science looks more like astrological charts. I cover Malcolm Light's extraordinary work in painful detail in my Radio EcoShock blog posted June 6, 2013, titled, Will Humans Go Extinct Soon? The point here, Malcolm Light described the need to mount a planet-saving effort to drill natural gas in the Arctic. His proposal has the delightful name, The Angels Project. I found this in a PowerPoint presentation by Light titled, A Proposal for the Prevention of Arctic Methane. ANGELS is an acronym for Arctic Natural Gas Extraction Liquefaction Sales. The subtitle reads, A Proposal for the Prevention of Arctic Methane Included Catastrophic Global Climate Change by Extraction of Methane from Beneath the Permafrost. And then he calls it, Towards Sales of a Subsidized Green Gas Energy Source. Green gas, my, yeah. Yes. We will save the world by finding and burning all the natural gas in the Arctic. Malcolm Light continues, this will also act as an incentive to oil companies to produce methane in large quantities from the Arctic methane hydrate reserves. In this way, the Arctic methane reserves will be continually reduced in a safe, controlled way over the next 200 to 300 years, exclamation mark, supplying an abundant green LNG energy source to humanity. Oh, if I sound breathless, I am. That just leaves me speechless. Yeah. From a climate perspective, this is absolute madness, but it is music to the ears of big hungry corporations like Shell, who are always trying to drill in the Arctic, and to the Russian government, no doubt. An environmentally worried world might help them drill more gas. That sounds like heaven, doesn't it? But wait a minute. Would the current Russian government seize on an opportunity to create a distraction, perhaps use legitimate science to lead us away? You're probably aware of U.S. intelligence reports about Russian efforts at cyber warfare, the hacking, but also whole offices of people and operatives who create false personalities looking like homegrown friends. The U.S. natural gas industry is doing that, too. See the new article in Mother Jones by Rebecca Lieber, February 11th, 2021. Facebook comments on natural gas appear to be from your neighbors, but they really come from industry hacks who are positioned somewhere far away. They're using sophisticated software to fool you. It isn't just the Russians. In his new book, American climate scientist Michael Mann describes a number of wedge campaigns run to divide climate advocates. He points to a 2020 news story in The Guardian reporting that the social media conversation over the climate crisis is being reshaped by an army of automated Twitter bots. The article estimated that, quote, a quarter of all tweets about climate on an average day are produced by bots, end quote, with the goal of, quote, distorting the online discourse to include far more climate science denialism than it would otherwise, end quote. Now, that book is The New Climate War, The Fight to Take Back Our Climate. Listen to my interview with Dr. Mann about that book in my Radio EcoShock show posted January 23rd, 2021 at ecoshock.org. So look, you can find this on YouTube as well. There are so many promoted videos that are about climate denial rather than about climate change. Another example has just been from documents again. Russian efforts to discount belief in COVID-19 virus and to support anti-vaxxers. Perhaps you have seen Dr. Peter Hotez as an expert on American television and cable networks. He is the founder of the National School of Tropical Medicine at Baylor College of Medicine in Texas and director of the Texas Children's Hospital Center for Vaccine Development. On January 28, 2021, Dr. Hotez published his new paper, Anti-Science Kills, From Soviet Embrace to Pseudoscience to Accelerated Attacks on U.S. Biomedicine. Hotez gives a snapshot of the difficult Russian history of distorting science for totalitarian gains, but he says that did not end with the fall of the Soviet Union. Quote, although the exploitation of biomedical anti-science as a political instrument reached its darkest hour during the Great Purge, it did not end with Lysenko. Today, Russian politicization of biomedicine, the biological sciences as they apply, reveals a confusing or ambivalent system of legitimate scientific endeavors alternating with an ever-widening program of disinformation designed to undermine the field, end quote from Peter Hotez. And that's exactly what we're talking about with methane as well. So that is the Russian government approving the Arctic methane expeditions and controlling the results. Meanwhile, unlike China, climate science in Russia is almost completely invisible. When it does speak, it comes out through official channels only. As CBS News reports with Irina Ivanova last January, quote, in a document published on a government website last weekend, Prime Minister Dmitry Medvedev outlined a national adaptation plan that describes the potential benefits of global warming, end quote. Because this is what Vladimir Putin says about climate change. Nobody knows the origins of global climate change. In the history of our Earth, there have been periods of warming and cooling, and it could depend on processes in the universe, end quote. You see? And what else is he going to say? That the gas that is making his economy possible, his own personal wealth possible, is adding enough methane and carbon dioxide to wreck the future of the world? So Putin publicly explains why Greta Thunberg is just a schoolgirl not to be listened to, while the state press calls her mentally ill. Meanwhile, Russian bots and trolls work to persuade Australians their monster deadly bushfires were just started by criminals, and surely not climate change. Add it all up. I would not trust Russian pronouncements on climate or their ongoing campaign of fear about Arctic methane. But, friends and listeners, that is not the big story. We learn from this one case that it's just another example of how major governments around the world, probably including your own, have worked to undermine the case for climate action for decades. What else would you expect when the whole civilization is based on power from coal, oil, and gas? The vested interests from banks to the stocks to the old families trying to run everybody's countries are all in with fossil fuels. They don't want solar and wind. They don't want us to reduce our consumption. We, as deluded populations, also dependent on fossil power, keep allowing governments to stall action to stop the constant gush of greenhouse gases into the atmosphere. We just learned that even the supposed good guys, like Microsoft founder Bill Gates, has helped elect climate-denying politicians. You can find the details on that in the really great online newsletter called Heated, and that's by climate sleuth Emily Atkin. That one was posted around February 10, 2021. It happens all over. Canada shut down its government-funded climate science for 10 years under the Harper government, which ended only in 2015. Canada had one ship capable of carrying climate and ice scientists into its vast Arctic. Harper leased it out to the oil companies for exploration instead. Canadian climate scientists had to get permission from the Prime Minister's office to speak to the press. The PM's office would tell scientists what they could say. Doesn't that sound like what you might expect? Oh, I don't know. In Russia? Think of the total climate denial disaster of the Trump years. Research institutes were defunded and decapitated, with some of the best climate scientists chased away or fired. Listen to my interview with Dr. Pensander, posted on January 26, 2021 at ecoshock.org. Australia elected the coal lover Scott Morrison as prime minister. He also disbanded a world-class climate institute and government offices, and he did his best to scuttle the international climate talks. We've not even begun to discuss the underhanded and overt anti-climate action funded by the endlessly deep pockets of oil-producing monarchies like Saudi Arabia and so many more. Nobody has thoroughly covered that story yet. Maybe it's too dangerous to even look into it. I don't know. All this means we have allowed governments around the world to throw away the time when we could have stopped the endless killer heat waves, the fires, the rising seas, the superstorms, dying coral, dying everything. We let governments from monarchies to oligarchies to alleged democracies endanger life on this planet, including our own kids' future. If we can't change that, we really are doomed. This is Alex Smith, saying thank you for listening to Radio EcoShock. Please keep on caring about the living things of this world.
A best of Radio EcoShock replay.
David Archer on Radio EcoShock, February 2012.
Is planet Earth approaching a climate tipping point due to methane bubbling up from the seafloor in the Arctic? This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith. To sort out this big question, we have climate scientist, author, and professor at the University of Chicago, Dr. David Archer. David, welcome to Radio EcoShock. And again, some scientists and journalists who interview them are worried about methane from the Arctic could cause a runaway greenhouse effect. What are your thoughts on that?
Well, a runaway greenhouse effect involving methane, to me, what those words would mean is that you get some warming from some methane, which then causes more methane to come out, which gives you more warming, so a positive feedback in that sort of a cycle. But because methane breaks down so quickly, it's very hard to get as much radiative forcing, as much climate oomph out of methane as we are already getting from releasing fossil fuel CO2. So the response of climate to the methane is fairly muted unless it was just a huge release. And then you also would need the methane melting to respond very quickly to changes in the climate in order to have, you know, a feedback. And, you know, yet you look around at how methane comes out and all of those sources are slower than the lifetime of methane in the atmosphere. They don't respond instantaneously or within a year or two or something like that. They respond over centuries. And so I don't see the potential for a runaway greenhouse effect involving methane. But I do see the possibility that methane in ocean hydrates and carbon that's frozen into permafrost soils could eventually release carbon to the atmosphere that would add to the cumulative effect from all the CO2 that we've been releasing. So the methane wouldn't have much effect on climate in the next, you know, decades, but hundreds of years from now, the carbon from methane and from permafrost soils could be sort of like matching funds or something, that we put in so much carbon from fossil fuels and then the Earth throws in, you know, an amount that sort of matches what we do or something like that. So that would affect not the peak of the warming, but rather the long tail, which with CO2, as we talked about last time, 2 years ago, affects the climate for, you know, hundreds of thousands of years into the future.
Well, you know, this is a tough problem for a layperson to try and figure out, and that's partly why I called you. But I wonder, too, the stakes seem so high here. David, what if you're wrong? Aren't we playing with risks too dangerous to ignore?
I think that releasing CO2 to the atmosphere is already a risk too dangerous to ignore. I think suddenly getting worried about the climate when you think about methane is like, you know, thinking about, you know, getting fat from eating a little bit of icing on a huge piece of cake. You're already eating the huge cake. And so the methane is just sort of the icing. That's how I view it.
All right. Well, everyone in this conversation seems to agree on one point. Humans need to figure out a way to dial back the carbon dioxide in the atmosphere to reduce it by some means. Do we have any technology or change in civilization that could possibly do this?
The issue is not the technology. The issue is just making a decision. The main fossil fuel that we're concerned with is coal, because there's a lot more coal than there are oil reserves or natural gas. And so the big decision about Earth's climate is whether we burn all that coal or whether we decide to leave most of it in the ground. And if it just happened to turn out that we didn't have all this much coal, it wouldn't be anything that we would even worry about. They would just come up with new energy sources as a matter of, you know, normal human ingenuity and progress. I think the only question is, do we have the foresight and the collective intelligence to make the decision to leave it in the ground?
In September 2009, I interviewed you about your book, The Long Thaw, How Humans Are Changing the Next 100,000 Years of Earth's Climate. It taught me a lot. What are you working on now, and is a new book in the works?
Well, I've had a couple that just came out. I'm very proud of an edited book that Ray Pierre Humbert and I put together called The Warming Papers, of classic scientific papers going back hundreds of years that are at the foundation of the global warming forecast. And I just went online with my climate science class in a sort of open access format that anybody that wants to can create an account for themselves on my system and look at lectures and take quizzes and do labs and print out a certificate at the end if they make it. But I'm not writing any new books now. I'm working on modeling, actually, the methane hydrate inventory in the ocean. But it's, like I say, that's not really primarily a global warming question, as more a sort of fundamental scientific question, in my opinion.
Well, yes, I'm excited about your Open Climate Science 101 online. It looks like people can just go there, do it through the net, and teach themselves about climate science for free.
Yeah.
So I'm going to put a link to that in my blog at ecoshock.info so that people will be able to find it and use it. It's a great resource.
Well, 900 people have signed up so far. It's only been online for about 2 weeks now. But so far, I was afraid the wheels would fall off when lots of people started to load the system, but so far it seems to be working great.
Beautiful. Well, David, what are your parting words for people worried about a methane-driven tipping point developing in the Arctic?
I once made the analogy on Real Climate that getting scared because of methane is like, because remember at the time Toyota Priuses were in the news, that they had issues with brakes or something. I own a Prius. It's a great car. I've never had any problem with it. But just as sort of a meme to hook into, that say you're driving down the street and car is going 50 miles an hour and suddenly the brakes fail and you're headed toward, you know, parked car in front of you or something. That's CO2. And then finding out that the accelerator might have gotten jammed and so you're going to hit that parked car at, you know, 55 miles an hour. That's kind of like when you add methane in, again, sort of like frosting on the cake. The time to be scared is not when you discover about the accelerator. The time to be scared is when you discover about the brake, because the impacts of CO2 are already much bigger than anything I've seen proposed from what could happen from methane. We're already in the danger zone.
We've been talking with scientist David Archer, a professor at the University of Chicago. You can follow more of his work at the science blog, realclimate.org, and find helpful companion links for this interview in my show blog at ecoshock.info. David Archer, thank you so much for helping us out.
It's been great. Thank you.
As I said, not everyone agrees with David Archer. This is a hot debate among scientists right now. How serious is the methane threat? As I stewed about this, David Archer came back with another bit of audio he'd recorded in his office. It's an awful bet. Here is Archer's point about worst-case scenarios and being right or wrong.
Well, the most catastrophic proposal that I've heard comes from Shakova, who says that there are 50 gigatons of methane gas as bubbles underneath the sediments on the Arctic shelf, the Siberian shelf, which could all come out all at once. And I don't know if I believe that the sort of slow warming that is happening there could trigger all that to come out all at once. You'd need some sort of a trigger, like some huge earthquake or something. But if it did come out all at once, there's a interactive model that I published on my webpage that you can play with and see what happens. If you put in 50 gigatons of methane all coming out in a year, you can compare the climate forcing, the radiative forcing, the energy imbalance caused by that methane. You can compare that against the radiative forcing from fossil fuel CO2. And what you'd find is that the forcing from the methane after a big burp like that would be much bigger than the forcing is today from fossil fuel CO2. But it would go away in a couple of decades. And by the end of the century, the forcing from fossil fuel CO2 will be higher even than the methane spike was at its worst. So it almost seems to me like it would be a chance for humanity to sort of try it before we buy it for keeps with CO2. Might not even be such a bad thing at that.
So there you have it. Maybe a good burst of methane and a climate shock is what we need to bring humanity to our senses, to make us finally get out of denial and act. It's a horrible thought, but nothing else has worked so far. Thank you for listening.